and here's Stutz.
How do I describe my guest, Merida LeSueur? Merida LeSueur, one of the most lyrical of American writers, unknown to a great many Americans, too many, but now being known to more and more thanks to some of the young women who've discovered her for the first time. I say, how do I describe Merida LeSueur of the Midwest and of the Southwest and of Indian culture as well, and a poet and someone active who connects life and art? I know nobody who connects life and art as much as Merida LeSueur. Her most recent, she's 82, and writes now more than ever, she says, 8 to 10 hours a day. The feminist press has just put out reprints of her, many of her works, called Ripening, which is a beautiful title for it. And in it are some of the exquisite writings of Merida LeSueur, and powerful. And she's my guest this morning, and a personal view of her will be forthcoming during the conversation, how she influenced me. It's a personal matter, but I think it's worth mentioning. I should say that with the rediscovery of Merida LeSueur, although she would say, I've never been gone, and she hasn't, the New York Times, in a forthcoming Sunday book section, has come through with a rave review, and the reviewer who teaches at Dartmouth College, Belle Gelfand, says, it's a long history I span, Merida LeSueur said recently. Long, and one might add, stirring, inexhaustible, momentous. And alive and intact as a writer, ends the review after much enthusiastic commentary. Alive and intact as writer and woman, Merida LeSueur is here for us to find. My guest this morning and her thoughts, her reflections, some of her reading in a moment after this message.
April is Great Music Month at Mandel Hall, and the University of Chicago invites you to join in a most uncommon music festival with recitals by such renowned artists as Ellie Ameling and Dalton Baldwin, Jörg Demus and Jandy Gattani and Gilbert Kalish, as well as a special symposium featuring internationally acclaimed musicologist and pianist Charles Rosen. All seats are reserved, and series subscribers enjoy a discount. For complete information on Great Music Month at Mandel Hall, telephone 753-3568.
My daddy is an engineer. My brother drives a hack. Sister takes in washing and the baby balls the jack. And it looks like I'm never gonna cease my wandering. Oh, I've been a wandering early and late from New York City to the Golden Gate. And it looks like I'm never gonna cease my wandering. I've been working in the army, working on a farm, and all I gotta show for it is muscle in my arm. And it looks like I'm never gonna cease my wandering. There's fish in the ocean, eels in the sea, and a red-headed woman made a wreck of me. And it looks like I'm never gonna cease my wandering.
Born out of the call of winter in the north, in the swing and circle of the horizon, I am rocked in the ancient land. As a child, I first read the scriptures written on the scroll of frozen moisture by wolf and rabbit, by the ancient people and the newly come. In the beginning of the century, the Indian smoke still mingled with ours. The frontier of the whites was violent, already injured by vast seizures and massacres. The winter nightmares of fear poisoned the plains nights with psychic airs of theft and utopia. The stolen wheat in the cathedral-like granaries cried out for vengeance. Most of all, one was born into space, into the great resonance of space, a magnetic Midwestern valley through which the winds clashed in lassos of thunder and lightning at the apex of the sky, the very wrath of God.
Meredith LeSueur reading opening passages from an early piece of writing, The Ancient People and the Newly Come. This is your beginning. Somewhere in the Midwest, isn't it, as you write of it?
Iowa.
Iowa? This is Iowa. And as you hear, our mutual friend, Wynn Strachey, singing Wander, and leading right into your writing, doesn't it? So it begins, you and Iowa and Minnesota. And when did it begin, Meredith, this vision of yours and the writing?
Well, I suppose it begins when you're born, as I indicate there, into the 1900, in the beginning of the most bloody century of our world, I think. And I began to live it when I was... you had the struggles of the Middle West before the First World War were tremendous. The farm struggles, the union struggles. And Debs got 2-3 million votes in 1908. It was a tremendous period, and I participated in it because of my parents.
Your parents, and you speak of this, and particularly in your work, The Crusaders, your legacy is a quite remarkable one, from your grandmother, great-grandmother on to your mother and yourself.
I call them matriarchs. They were all radical matriarchs, you might say.
Your grandmother was an early suffragist and homesteader.
Yes. And also she belonged to the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which was a very radical group. It was not just against drinking. It was against like the battered women today, because you lost your check, it was drunk up, and I was a young 10 years old to the taverns, saloons, with the women who tried to shake down the fathers and husbands to get whatever was left on Saturday night, or their children didn't eat the next.
This was where? This was in...
This was in Oklahoma.
Wandering.
Yes,
here's that Wandering.
That's why
thing
I wanted
went.
That Wandering.
Yeah. So it was Iowa, Oklahoma, Kansas, Minnesota.
Texas. My mother had to kidnap us out of Texas in 1910 because the women and children were property of the man, of the father. We were actually property. They had no rights whatever.
You know, it's so funny as you say that. Again, it comes into the subject of parental rights, which, of course, has many dimensions to it. But it's interesting how every now and then something happens, and here's that assertion over and beyond what is a parent's feeling. And you remembered it. Your story is a story of the growth of our country, both ways, good and bad.
I think so. As I say, from 1900 was the great movement of the country into the global world.
But I'm thinking about your own life, and it's so connected with your writings. You were once first the child, and you knew some of these people, like Big Bill Haywood and Gene Debs.
Yes. My father was on the Red Special. Gene Debs crossed the country in 1908. So he was often at our house, and wonderful, one of the great men of our time.
You knew Emma Goldman, too.
Yeah, I lived in the anarchist house in 1915.
I'm thinking about you and writing and acting. You were, people who read your writings don't know, you were a stunt woman in the movies. And you do stunts for Pearl White in Perils of Pauline.
Well, my whole life, I guess, has been a stunt how to survive in the 20th century. Yes, I was trying to make a living, and so I got a job I was a pretty good athlete.
Mm-hmm.
I got a job with the Pearl White. I did all the stunts. Like, first thing I did was jump off a burning ship and I was a good swimmer in sweet water in Minnesota, but I heard the ocean was salty, but I didn't know how salty. I almost was killed the first day I was working there. Then you had to sign a release when you got these jobs, releasing them from any responsibility. If you were killed, You were supposed to bury yourself. They had no response. Many extras were killed because it was dangerous.
Either that, they wanted to sign you up as a starlet, too.
Well, they had stables then, they called them, stables of women, who they developed. So the director, Pearl White, was a man who later became Garbo's director, and he was building himself a stable of women. You signed it to be 2 years, or you would be trained to walk and talk, and you had to sign up. You wouldn't do anything else in that time. But then the contract said that I had to have my nose broken, that nobody could be a star without a snub nose, what do you call it?
A little button nose.
Yeah. So I don't know. I just thought I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't have my nose.
But you always were this independent woman. You did everything. You were stuntman. You worked in sweatshops. You worked as cook. You worked as maid. But were you always writing?
Yes, I think I began when I was about 10 to write notes and take down the speech. I thought the Midwestern American had the most beautiful speech in the world, the most poetic. So I used to take down the speeches and in Fort Scott. I sat behind the water trough on Saturday taking down the farmer's speech.
Yeah, I'm thinking I'm almost could point to any part of this book called Ripening, a selected work of Marital Lesueur from 1927 to 1980, and the Feminist Press are publishing it. And by the way, Grace Paley, who's one of our best of our short story writers, mm-hmm. says of Meridell, says, I'm glad that Marital Lesueur began her life a few years before me, so I was able to read when I was young her wonderful stories about working people in cities and towns in the Midwest, how bravely they lived on this earth, as bravely as she herself through hard economic times, through persecutions. For years she was hidden from us by the big daddies of the literary direction and the bigger daddies of political power. She's in her 80s. I'm grateful we can read her stories again. Grace Paley.
Oh, that's nice.
And, Meryl, so I'm thinking of the writers who acclaimed you way back. Sinclair Lewis and Zona Gale and Sandberg and young Nelson Algren. But it's you and the writing. It's, you say, the American language, you find.
Well, when I went to school, you couldn't be a writer unless you imitated the English. Nobody was even studied except English writers. I remember in 30, Carl Sandburg was hissed at the University of Minnesota. You couldn't appear there except as a British writer or a European writer. So it was a tremendous struggle to have an American culture. You know, it began in 1915 when I associated with Henry, and the Ashcan painters had a great influence on me, and Stieglitz. Mm-hmm. I remember when I first saw on the door of Stieglitz said American Place, I burst into tears because I never saw that. I knew that it was true that I lived in an American place. Mm-hmm. But it was a real struggle to make an American image, an American, it still is perhaps.
Yeah. It occurred to me, you mentioned Stieglitz, that you know you worked recently with George O'Keefe.
Yeah, in that period there was New York was a tremendous, Gene Toomer and Marsden Hartley and Dove. To paint, look at an American image was a real revolutionary thing.
I'm thinking of your life and your art, Marital, how it's so much as though the story of American, I use the word culture with a small c in the rich sense, and its political life and its growth is your very life itself, as though you've experienced every aspect of the ups and downs.
I only had one virtue. I was very timid and shy, but I always appeared where it was happening, no matter what. I wrote an essay in 1930 called Corn Village, in which I said I was not, that generation was going to Paris, you know. I said I was not going to leave. I was going to stay with the Middle West because its life was my life and its death was mine also. That was 30.
Yeah.
So then I stayed.
You mentioned Corn Village. Corn itself has become almost, it's Indian, it's American, and it's the very nature of growth. That's become almost your symbol in writing, your pillar.
Well, it's the basis of the Midwest economy. More wealth was made from corn than any jewels or silver mines or gold mines. And besides, corn is one of the only things that was entirely created by people. And it can't grow except with people. It can't release its kernel, which I think is a wonderful symbol of a relationship of the human to the
to nature.
Corn. And I'm writing a long saga about that.
So you're writing it now. By the way, you're 82 now, and you're writing full-time, aren't you now?
Well, it's the first time I've had full-time. I don't feed anybody or earn anybody's living. You know, I raise two children myself. And a woman really doesn't have time. I have full-time to write now for the first time in my life.
You know, if you read, I'm just choosing things arbitrarily, this book of the American language. You're writing. In the North Star Country is one of the best pieces I've seen about a region. It is both history and folklore at the same time, isn't it?
Yes.
Just almost anything. Here, the man and the woman, I just point this out. I'm asking you to sight read, which is unfair, but...
The man and woman moving behind the westering sun wanted room to think fast and big, invent, speak, plant land and children with freedom's plow. They wanted new ways of being together. They hankered after something beside death and taxes. They wanted to see straight and live on earth. Like the growth of scientific thought, the twin of democracy, they wanted to examine the humus, look at decay, the minutiae of soil and society, honor the lowest labor and growth. Hard-headed, they wanted their pie in the here and now. Every man under his tree, no man a servant. Horse sense or common sense was common doings. They all had it together because without it, they would not survive.
Yeah. It's funny, you pick up the language, the idiom, and the poetry both. You mentioned the humus. That's a key image with you, isn't it? Yes, what is literature? And somewhere, and you speak of...
That's the fertile earth, then.
Literature, Marital has said, it must spring from the deep and submerged humus of our life.
Of course, the humus in the Midwest was 13 or 14 feet straight down of pure earth. Not a stone, not a rock. Unknown in the world up to that time.
So it's the richness. You see the richness of American speech and literature connect with the richness of the land itself.
Well, it was the basis of democracy. The Free Land, the Homestead Act, was the first time in the world that free land was given to people from Europe. Even the Jewish people who never could own land in Europe had free land, 160 acres. It was a real humus of democracy that was planted there.
Your grandmother was a homesteader, wasn't she?
Yes, Well, you know, they opened Oklahoma by shooting off a gun, and everybody was lined up, and everybody tore in and took a piece of the Indian land.
Your grandmother, one of them?
Yes, she had a horse and buggy and a shotgun.
That's now, we come to a key. And I've underlined this several times. Marital Lesueur, continuity. Now, continuity, that is as a past to all of us, as a richness to a past, but you always believe in this continuation, and yet at this moment it seems there's been a break in continuity. Many of the young have no past.
I think that is a conspiracy deliberately created. I say in our culture we have dismemberment, and I call for rememberment, to remember. I mean, history has really been trashed. You're not supposed to know what happened, especially in the people's struggles of it. It's been a deliberate, I think it's been a deliberate conspiracy to cover up the anti-monopoly struggle of people.
Well, I know, for example, reading a history of the Depression, since I worked on the book Hard Times, many of the young read it for the first time, they had no idea. And, of course, in the history books, you know about Franklin Roosevelt elected four times, and you know about, they use the word breadline, and that's about it. You see a man selling, a World War I vet selling an apple, and then the war. But that's all they know about it. And you're talking about what actually happened, but you do it so lyrically. This is the point.
Oh, you think I make it look better by being...
No, my point is your own poetry comes into it.
Yes. Well, I think the American people are very lyrical people. I mean, they're singing people.
But also you call upon folklore as well as ancient myth. One of the earliest stories is Persephone. And this is in Greek legend, who went down to hell, was kidnapped, and separated from her mother, Demeter. This is a recurring theme of all your writings, isn't it?
I connect it with the destruction of the land right now. I mean, if you had the nourishing mother, you wouldn't be poisoning the rivers and destroying the land. I think it's part of that myth of the mother and the daughter and the nourishing of the world. I mean, we've trashed that so we can destroy, you know, we are destroying the earth.
See, one of the earliest of your pieces of writing on page 76 of this quite rich book, Ripening, Persephone. That was one of the earliest stories, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Well, the very, suppose you read just the opening. It's ancient Greek myth, and yet it's a Kansas girl.
Yes, I associated myself with my own mother with that myth. And with the, you can read in here the destruction of the land. And that was in 28 I wrote this.
28.
We boarded the train at a Kansas town. Its black houses sat low amidst the fields, which were hardening and darkening now the summer was over. The corn had been shocked. The seed lay in the granaries. The earth had closed. And now the sun hung naked in the sky. All was over. The festival, the flowering, the harvesting. Dark days had come, and I was taking the daughter of Frida away to discover, if I could, the malady which made her suffer. And I think that's related to the destruction of the land, which was going on. That was just prior to the Depression.
Yeah. So this prior to Depression, destruction of land, is also separation of mother and daughter.
Right, and the mother then brought drought upon the earth because of the kidnapping of her daughter.
And so Persephone, Demeter theme. And you were, so come back to continuity as also change and regeneration. You remembering, as you say, you remembering, you become Demeter now, today. You are now the mother.
Yeah, that's part of the myth, the mother turning into the daughter and the daughter turning into the mother. In the myth, Persephone comes back to Demeter and becomes a mother. And she's 6 months on the earth and 6 months away. That's what made her 6 months of winter and 6 months of summer.
But also something else here, another influence on you, and that's the American Indian influence on you. Since you speak of corn, and you speak of cycles. This is a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And this is part of an Indian religion and culture, isn't it?
Well, I think we all have the Indian in us. I mean, we came in, and the Indian was a profound influence. Sinclair Lewis had a wonderful line once. He said, every American bears the face of Tecumseh. And it's more true now than ever. It comes up in us all, and the ecology of the land we are taking from the Indian now, because they cared for the land. They call it a mother, even. I think the influence of the Indian is tremendous now.
Again, I'm just this is, I find, a very exciting hour, my being with you right now. And I can just almost, I'm just turning pages of the book Ripening by Marita LeSueur. And just as you say that, here's from ancient people, the ancient people, the newly come. And you're speaking of an Indian woman whom you knew named Zona.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who was Zona?
Well, she was, just as I say there, she was an Indian woman, was part of our family, and my grandmother and my mother took care of the children and came and helped us. And the Indians taught everybody how to live on the droughty Oklahoma plains, for example. And she was really part of our life and very much like the women of my family.
Zona was like your mother and your grandmother.
Yes, and they had much in common.
Perhaps this sequence right here that you're talking about, to learn about the nature of land or the nature of nature, learning from the Indians. And here's a sequence right there that hits me.
She showed me, this is the Indian woman, that the earth was truly round, sacred, she said, so that no one could own it. This land is not for taking, she said, and I am not for taking. You can't have anything good in the square or in five, all must be four or seven. You can't divide the land in the square, she said. She made the whole landscape shift and encircle me. She said the earth went far down, and the whites could only buy and deed the top. The earth waited, its fingers clasped together like columns. She closed her brown fingers to show the interlocking. She said that men and women were rooted, interpenetrating, turning to the center. She did not believe in hell or heaven. She believed we were here, now, in this place. She said the earth would give back a terrible holocaust to the white people for being assaulted, plowed up, and polluted. She said everything returned. Everything was now, in this time. She said past, present, and future were invented. by the white man.
You know, this is, oh, past, present, future invented by the white man. The Indian sees it all as one.
There's no past, present, and future in the English language, even.
You know,
I don't think you could have gotten people in the factory without having linear consciousness of time.
I'm going to ask you how that's affected your writing, because I know that you are now, even now, at 82, experimenting.
I'm trying to do away with the linear consciousness entirely, because that's the line towards the bomb. I mean, a straight line of progress leads to destruction. And that's how if we progress fast enough towards the doubling of energy, then we don't think anything is following us. We're not polluting the earth. But if you're thinking circularly and cyclically, you know whatever you do, your shit's going to fall on you.
Yes. That's amazing. Yeah. As you say it, it's so clear. But this is also part of Indian influence, too, isn't it?
Yes,
that
it
everything
is
circular, and I suppose everything that rises must converge.
Well, you heard that the earth is a globe, haven't you?
Yeah, we know that much. It is not.
No, I don't think we do know.
Oh, wait
it.
A
I mean,
minute.
Thinking it.
You're saying that those who think linear and head toward the bomb, like 2 and 2 is 4 and four is 8, really think, work on the proposition that the earth is flat.
That they do. That's it. A straight line must go on a flat.
Yeah, that's right.
Surface.
So they're operating on the earth is flat.
Right. You couldn't get out of Vietnam because you had to win or lose. I mean, that linear thinking is really political danger to us.
Mary LeSueur is my guest, as you can gather. She thinks quite, put it mildly, stunningly clearly, and her writing is poetic and realistic. Well, that's just the point. It's realistic and lyrical at once. This is what we're talking
and
about.
And I call it surrealistic also.
Surreal, too.
Because, you know, it tries to see the relationship of objects. The linear thing also makes everything an object on a straight line. You can seize it and alienate it, and all the philosophies come from the straight line thinking, I think, like Sartre and all those miserable, retarded philosophers.
You think he's retarded? Sorry, yeah. You mean, well, the idea of what? The idea of despair?
Objectifying and not being in things. You put them outside of you, and that makes alienation. Because their philosophy, the further it was outside of you, the better it was. You were alienated from it. You had no responsibility. Existentialism, you acted without relationship, or you acted, but you didn't have any core to the action or any circular return. Or
well, as you're saying, I'm thinking about this passage you read from The Ancient People Newly Come. You wrote 19, The Ancient People.
Oh, I wrote it in 76.
You wrote this in 76.
Mm-hmm.
Because how contemporary it is, our Zona, the Indian woman, showing you the circular nature, how the land works and how of course, it's really a variation of the biblical theme. One sows, one shall reap,
right,
I suppose.
Ezekiel and Isaiah said that.
And so I'm thinking about you're writing this and what, say, James Watt, Secretary of Interior, is doing to the land in the name of whatever it's called.
Yes, then it's very destructive. It's a linear invasion, a colonization. It's a colonization of the land. And I associate that with women also, with the women's struggle. Women are also colonized by the linear structure. Because women are really round.
Mary LeSueur is my guest. And we're going to resume in a moment. I'm going to ask about her influences, particularly D.H. Lawrence in her younger days, the role he played in her writing. And by the way, if I could remind you, or tell you some of her other writings, I first remember her short stories in 1940, Salute to Spring, and also one of the most beautiful of all children's books about Abe Lincoln's mother, Nancy Hanks, and what happened when you visited her grave, and, of course, her poetry, too. But Ripening is this book now, with an excellent introduction by Elaine Hedges and Mary LeSueur. It's Feminist Press, the publishers. And she'll be appearing, by the way, this Saturday, April 3rd, at 1 o'clock at the Guild Bookstore. That's 1118 West Armitage at 1 o'clock. And to meet Marital is an experience,
and
an
evening,
too.
Evening reading.
And you'll be reading there, too.
In the evening.
In the evening. But we'll resume in a moment after this message.
You're listening to Studs Terkel on WFMT in Chicago. Marvelous mink samples with the prestigious name Maximilian are on sale now through tomorrow in the Fur Salon at Bonwit Teller in the John Hancock Center. It's your chance to save 20 to 75% on Maximilian Milk, mink, a sensational sample mink coat or jacket. When you see it, you'll know it simply has to be a Maximilian, and the savings make it even more striking. But you have only 2 days for the maximum minimums of mink. Mink samples at 20 to 75% off from Maximilian in the Fur Salon at Bonwit Teller in the John Hancock Center. When a million green stamps fall into your lap, anything can happen. When Germaine Lauzon of Montreal wins those stamps and invites her 14 best friends over to paste them into hundreds of little books, gossip and stamps start flying. It's the American premiere of a dangerously funny comedy by Michel Tremblay, Les Belles Sœurs, or The Sisters-in-Law, and it's now playing at Northlight Repertory, 2300 Green Bay Road in Evanston. For tickets and information on Les Belles Sœurs, telephone Northlight at 869-7278. Back again to Studs and his guest.
Resuming with Merida LeSueur. And, oh, first, a personal note. I once took a writing class, the only one I ever took in my life. It was two one-hour sessions, all I attended. Oh, I know what it did for me. It just accelerated me. You were the teacher. It was 1939, 1940.
Came from Minnesota.
Just when Salute to Spring came out. And I sat in that class, and suddenly I realized, hey, this is an exciting and exhilarating adventure. Because what you made it. And somehow you said, call upon that which you know, your world. Something about my grandmother, I forget.
I always hoped that it had some influence on your wonderful work of interviewing people. You know, that was my passion then, of talking to people. And starting, there wasn't any tape recorders then.
No.
I have a whole basement of my daughter's material that I interviewed with farmers and people and...
I'm sure it did play an influence on me. But since you mentioned that, we know that in the WPA days, or the Writers' Project, many of the people working on the project went out and interviewed people and got their lives down on paper.
And all those the files now are in every state, not used. They're just packed up in gunny sacks in Minnesota. You know, they're incalculable material of interviews, but you can't use them because you have to read all that stuff.
There's a young woman writer named Ann Banks, just did a beautiful book called First Person America.
Oh.
And it's a lot of the writings she's uncovered in the various archives and
First
files.
First Person America.
Yeah. But coming back to you, Marital, and early influences, you were writing and you remembered and you talked to people near and around and about you, and you read, of course. But D.H. Lawrence played influence on you.
Well, you can't understand Lawrence unless you understand the time that he wrote. He died in 27 or 8, and any kind of sexual writing was absolutely unknown, I mean, in the Puritan world. And I learned that you could look at sexual, especially of women. He wrote amazingly about women. And I think it opened doors to everyone at that time. You have to look at him in relation to the time, and Puritanism was so, in my life, that, you know, the Puritan, Midwest Puritan was a real closed, absolutely closed. My grandmother was, you know, just buried in this fort that she built around. So it was very hard to have a body, to get a body, you know, to be in anything. It was so he had a tremendous freeing influence on, I think, on that period. You can read him now, and sometimes it's really ununderstandable, some of it. But at the period, it was a tremendous freeing in Puritan America, Lawrence.
So that helped free you to some extent from
tremendous. I mean, you couldn't write about sex at all. You didn't know how, for one thing.
Well, you did everything. I mean, you caught every aspect of a woman's life there. Even during the 30s, now the Depression, here again, you were one of the earliest of journalists who I'd call subjective journalists. You know, I Was Marching is a marvelous piece of journalism. You know, we've been taught this phony idea of objective journalism,
right,
as though there isn't any such thing.
And you go back to the existentialists again, and Sartre, and, you know, and their alienation.
But you also used to speak out And you got in trouble, of course, naturally. Speaking out in the 50s in the McCarthy days. Mm. So what happened to your writings then? Were you still writing during those bleak days?
Yeah, I wrote notes. I have 140 notebooks, which probably contain... Tilly Olson came down to the basement, burst into tears, and she said, you have to copy these. You know, they're a heritage of... So I just, you can write, an actor like Gigi or like you in the period, you have to have an outlet, but you can write.
A reference to Gigi, Meryl's an old friend of ours, Lou Gilbert, who died last year, who was a friend of Meryl's and mine. But you were talking about writing.
Well, you mentioned my children's books. They couldn't be sold except under the counter. So I ate them. I mean, that was my economic. Knopf was the only publisher that defended the writer, but you couldn't sell any of my books. The Milwaukee Journal said it shows how low a radical will stoop to write such beautiful English to ruin our children.
That's known as a perverse tribute.
Wasn't that strange?
Now, of course, today they honor you. Okay. I'm thinking about one of the children I most remember, so many of you, about Nancy Hanks, Lincoln's mother.
Mm-hmm.
And you went to visit the grave.
Yes.
What did you discover?
Well, I went to visit where he was born. Yes, in the grave when he was born. Where he was born is a big Greek marble edifice, and inside is a little corner with a three-cornered legged bed where Nancy gave birth to Abe. And around the corner is just great statements by Aristotle, Plato, all the great retarded philosophers. And not one word about Nancy Hanks. And and then I went to the village where nobody could remember who she was. And I was almost thrown out of the village by people who suspected me of something, asking about Nancy Hanks in the village.
Because who was Nancy Hanks, they wanted to know. Yeah, and so this is, again, I suppose no accident that today you're still writing as much as you did before, as fruitfully today as then, perhaps even more so. You know, Verdi wrote his greatest opera, Falstaff, in the 80s.
Is that right?
So
oh,
there we are.
Well, I once had lunch with Carl Sandburg and Frank Lloyd Wright, and they were 85, and they said they were doing their best work, and if sclerosis didn't set in, they expected to be doing their best work at 90, most creative work. Sclerosis did set in, and they didn't live that long.
But they were, but that was Wright in his 80s and Sandberg in his
80s. They were 85.
And there's Meryl Lasseur, just thriving now. I suppose the birth of it, but the reoccurrence of the feminist movement in recent years and the discovery by a lot of young women, writers and others of you, I suppose it's played a role, hasn't it?
Yes, and I think also the conception of a global world, you know, the communication in the world is so fantastic. Never existed in my life. And the consciousness that we're no longer in the dark of the open market, that, you know, the fate is of all people, is one.
Yeah. And I'm talking also, since it's a circular history, past, present, and future, rolled into one, as the Indians say, is this affecting your writing now, too?
Yes, I'm trying to do away with the narrative line. You know, all of our culture is based upon the straight line, a climax leading to a goal, which I consider a straight line concept. Even music, 19th century, is based upon the theme of developed and climaxes towards a goal. Well, I'm trying to do away with that and not write in a straight line. I call it a nounless novel.
A nounless novel.
Because the noun is what you seize, you name it, and that's the end of it. That's where alienation comes from. You alienate the object, then you can sell it, seize it, colonialize it, destroy it. You can't destroy the earth if you're really in relation to it. The Indian language in America has no nouns. It only has the relationship. Einstein said you couldn't express relativity in American language, only in the Chinese and the American Indian.
And yet Einstein said that, and yet at the same time you find this richness in American language. So what you're trying to do is to free the American language.
Especially the academic language. I mean, I don't think that's true in the vernacular. People talk in the... No, but I think it's a very important concept. We name it and that's the end of it. Like this Indian woman said, We name a rock, and that's the end of the rock. They have a language that the rock is different if it's coming to hit you.
Yeah, oh.
Or if you're throwing a rock at your enemy, it's an entirely different relationship.
You know, as you're talking, I'm just leafing through Merida LeSueur's book, and it's Ripening, it's called, Selected Works 1927 to 1980. And I was about to say, I'm looking for something, and just almost anything here. To those who remember, oh, this is your mother you're talking about. This is in an earlier work called The Crusaders, too.
Uh-huh.
And you speak of her and a time.
To those who remember my mother as an independent, aggressive, bold, and brilliant woman, it is difficult to understand that for each of these distinctions, she had to fight most of society, public opinion, and the laws of the land. Women especially would like to believe that her talents were God-given, but it was not so. Her anger, her strength, her determination, even her brilliance and her oratory were things she developed often alone and struggled and fought for as much as Frederick Douglass had to struggle to even read. In Texas, her husband divorced her on the grounds of dangerous thoughts gleaned from reading books.
So now we come to reading books. And one of the things you point, little known, you know, one of the problems today is we're told that there's less reading because of the nature of TV and radio. We know a lot of paperbacks are sold, and we see people reading on buses, but what they're reading are these ersatz romances, you know. So you point out that working people, pioneers, farmers, a great many were surprisingly well-read.
Well, I think that's true. I think it's still true. Because you can't find out the ways of struggle. If you're hungry, you have to look for food. And if people are being oppressed and beaten down like now, you have to look for ways of the past or ways of struggle. Or you have to find it in the philosophy, in the word. And I think that I spoke last night to a group of steel workers in Gary, you know, who were asking how can they find literature to survive now they're out of work. They want to know, you know, what are the patterns of people's struggle in the past. And they hardly knew anything about the past. You know, the third parties or the union, even the union. They have some union knowledge from this class they take as a union history. Yeah. They really don't know the big, great struggles of the American people. And their survival depends upon knowing it.
We come back to the whole matter of those. Mm-hmm. Your legacy, and there were these little books. I remember 1920, little E. Haldeman Julius Blue books. Mm-hmm. Aristotle, forgive me, Plato for a nickel. We'll forget Plato for now, but we'll go to, you know, Shakespeare's plays, complete for a dime.
Mm-hmm.
Darwin for a nickel. Bob Ingersoll for a nickel.
Mm-hmm.
And so guys would carry these in their hip pockets, wouldn't they?
Well, they were designed to fit in the overall pocket, you know, which says something about their quality.
Yeah, I'm thinking also, again, just leafing through the book, those visiting early America, the visitors who came, those who saw nothing except the Boston, living with Boston society, and nothing of the, thought little Mrs. Trollope, little of the frontier, but Harriet Martineau saw something else.
Many of them did, And, of course, it was a miracle for people out of Europe, crowded in the land of Europe, to come here to the prairies, free land, as I said. Never in the world had there been free land for oppressed people. You could get 160 acres by simply sitting on it and building a log cabin, and that was a miracle.
And it's funny how everything you do is related. You speak of that, and you speak again of the break in history, the mother, daughter, the mythic separation of Persephone from Demeter, and finally the daughter becoming the mother.
Yes.
As in your case, literally.
And now the women's movement is related to that.
Yeah.
You know.
And the dark of the time you have here, another writing, dark of the, and you quote Blake, does the eagle know what is in the pit, or will you ask the mole? And of course, she, Persephone, was taken into the dark.
Into the dark, into the under.
And so this is a movement a move, I should say, a journey through darkness into light, I suppose, to use a simple...
Well, that's a women's journey. A child is born out of dark. I mean, the intrauterine life is a symbol of that birth out of the cave, out of the dark, out of the water, out of the underground, out of danger even is involved in it.
And we think of women and the women writers, of course, when you were a young girl, a young woman now in the 30s, the tremendous number of good women writers.
Yes.
Have, you know, going to be developing this question. You know, on a national level, and it's going to be a very tough field. And like I say, there'll be certain political figures in the of us delegates.
Yeah, you had your hand up right at the same time, so go ahead.
Yeah, I just have one short thing to raise that's raised in the paper. On page 4, it talks about how this, maybe it's just this particular movement towards an independent third party in the second to the last paragraph. That is, it refers to it as being headed by the NAM forces. You know, and just from my... brief look on this stuff is that